feel like I should apologize since we're so over time. I plan this to take about an hour, and I'd like to know if that's okay. I don't want to keep anyone from their food. Okay. It probably seems ridiculous, but that makes me feel better that I'm not wasting everybody's time. Well, I'd really just like to say, first of all, especially in lieu of the pressure Mark just placed upon me, I would like to say that I really do appreciate being asked to speak here. There are very few venues around in this world, despite what, you know, Michael just talked about. There are very few venues around where those of us who are here can actually get to talk about the things that we get to talk about here at this gathering. And that fact alone makes this gathering a very special thing, and I'm very glad to be a part of it, and I'm sure everyone else is glad to be a part of it as well. Gatherings like this can be very, very valuable things. I think for all of us they're kind of a bit of a pause from the normal continuous work we all do of pressing on through the sonship curriculum, wherever each of us happen to be in it. They're kind of a break from dealing with whatever component of instruction, whatever form of doctrine that each of us are currently engaged in dealing with. But that pause really gives us, I think, an opportunity to kind of lift our heads up, as it were, from our labors and sort of take stock of things, of what's going on, where we're going. And particularly, I think this is a good opportunity for us to think about, first of all, why we're doing sonship in the first place, what the goal is, what the objective is of this work that we're all doing. But also, and this is what I want to focus on in this session, there are a chance to reflect upon how we're doing sonship, to think a bit on the process of edification, now that we've kind of paused for a moment in that process. And after this gathering is over, it's those sorts of thoughts and those sorts of understandings that can help us, each of us, get back to doing that normal work of sonship edifying that we all participate in. And that's why this is a great opportunity for Mark to talk about godliness, like he's been doing, aside from just, you know, the normal extra knowledge and perception that gives us. It really reminds us of the purpose of all the sonship work that each of us are doing, the objective we're trying to reach by working through this sonship curriculum, which of course is godliness, like we just talked about, God-likeness. That's the objective. And when I heard what Mark was planning to do here, I thought it would be appropriate to kind of use this gathering, this short pause in each of our trajectories through the curriculum, to not only talk more about the godlike objective of our sonship life, but to reflect a bit on the actual work of doing sonship, on how it is that the curriculum is able to do in us what it actually does, and the work that we have to do to let the curriculum do its work. And so what I want to do in this session is really, on one level, quite simple, and on another, not so much. I want us to think about not only the objective of sonship education, but also the means to that objective. That is kind of how we interact with God's sonship curriculum. And this is something that recently I've come to appreciate more and more deeply as I've kind of delved into this and noticed how it works with me. And I appreciate much more deeply than I do before. And what I hope to do in this session is really help all of us, you know, get towards a deeper and deeper appreciation of just how this sonship education actually works and works in our inner man. So more specifically, what I'd like us to start thinking and reflecting upon is how we as individuals actually engage with this sonship curriculum, how we engage with it as individuals and how we engage with it as a group. And that is to say, how we interact with it, how we interact with the curriculum, and how the curriculum interacts with us, and how we change because of the curriculum, and how it changes us. Because those interactions, those changes, really should be happening to us as we go along through this curriculum, as we press on through it. But those sorts of things don't happen automatically. We do have to work at this curriculum to get the effectual benefit from it. And that's kind of the work that I'd really like us to start thinking more and more about as we go on through the curriculum and start paying greater and greater attention to it, and to keep attending to this issue after this gathering is over and as we get back to work. And this is a very personal issue. It's an issue between you and God your Father. It's about what passes between the two of you by way of this sonship curriculum, and that makes this subject that I'm trying to address a very, very difficult subject to try and talk about, because it's so personal and it's so so intimate, really. But we have to try to talk about this issue, this interface between us and the curriculum, because it's a pivotal issue in our sonship lives, and we really need to understand it to extract as much of the benefit from the sonship education as we can. So just to try to sum all of that up and be clear, I'm not trying to teach a doctrine here in this session. I'm not trying to give you an exhortation, or at least not a curricular exhortation. And I'm not trying to just give a bunch of information that we can tuck away into a repository of Bible data. But my goal here, what I want to achieve in this session, is for us to start thinking about something which is very important, which is how you and the sonship curriculum interact with one another, how you interact with it, and how it interacts with you, and specifically how you read from it and how you learn from it, and ultimately how it in turn reads you. And ultimately what we're thinking about when we're thinking about this issue is we're thinking about how it actually edifies you, the actual mechanical means by which the sonship curriculum actually produces this edificational work. Not just that it edifies you, not just the fact that it edifies you, but how it actually edifies us as we go through it. And this is really important for us to think about, because when you're learning pretty much anything, and sonship doctrine is no exception, gradually appreciating more about how you learn helps with the actual learning process itself. So it pays to think about how this edificational process works, about how we interact with the sonship curriculum. So that's just kind of my advertisement for why this is important and what I'm trying to do here. So to start off and try to work towards this, and really to kind of just get right to the heart of the matter, there's an issue that I really want to raise, and one that I'd like each of us to really honestly think about for a minute. And this may not seem very important at all at first, but I think it really is quite important, and it kind of gets to the heart of what I want to talk about. And the issue is, what are you doing when you are reading? What are you doing when you are reading? And it's actually not a ridiculous question. And I do mean by what are you doing when you're reading, I mean reading God's Word, not reading a newspaper or something like that. And at least for today, I mean reading a piece of the sonship curriculum. So what are you doing? What are you actually doing when you're reading something that you know is there to effectually work in and ultimately edify you? Kind of in the same vein, what's happening when you're guided through the curriculum by your pastor? Because that's a form of reading too, guided reading through the curriculum. Basically, the issue is, what are you doing when you're interacting with the sonship curriculum, when you're learning from it? What's happening to you when you're doing that work? And I don't mean activities around reading or around learning in class. I don't mean the context. Think about the actual act of reading, the act, the activity of learning something, that kind of that activity or that little bundle of activities that we call reading. What are you doing when you, either privately or guided in class by a pastor, interact with the sonship curriculum? In other words, what is happening in our minds? What is your mind doing? And what is being done to it when we learn and read from God's curriculum? That's kind of what I have in mind when I ask, what are you doing when you're reading? Or what are you doing when you're learning from this curriculum? And what I want to do in this session is really just deal with that question itself, or rather deal with the issues that this question raises. Because in sonship, how we read matters. It matters quite a lot. Not just that we read, not just that we learn doctrine, but how we do that work. Both when we're being taught and when we're thinking about what we're being taught. So what I really want to do in this session is kind of twofold. First, and I guess this would be my primary objective, I want to sketch out why this is actually important for learning sonship. And my secondary objective would be that we'll start to appreciate even more of how the sonship curriculum actually works in us. And that's basically what I want to accomplish in this session. So in simple terms, and it really is quite simple, this reading issue. What are we doing when we're reading? Reading is important because reading is the main point of interface between us and the sonship curriculum. It's the main point of interface between us and God our Father, and moreover, it's the main point of interface between us and our Father's mind. There is sonship prayer, of course, which is an important interface between us also, but sonship prayer really depends upon how you interface with the curriculum in the first place, because that's mainly what you pray about. So reading is this primary interface between us and the sonship curriculum. And I mean, by reading, I mean both privately reading the curriculum alone, and second, much of the work that a pastor does in Bible class, guiding us through our reading of the sonship curriculum. Those are two different things, but they still work together to the same objective. And I'm referring to both because each one of those processes is a help to the other one. So that's reading, and because reading is this primary interface between us and God's Word, the quality of that interface, not just the quantity, but the quality of that interface, of how we do it, really helps determine the quality of what we learn. It determines how thoroughly, how completely His Word is able to change us. That's kind of what's at stake when we're interfacing with God's Word through this act of reading. So the issue isn't merely that we read God's Word, that we interface with God's Word. The important issue is how we read God's Word and how we interface with the sonship curriculum. And to talk about how we are reading, we need to talk about that act of reading itself. We need to think about the actual activity of reading, what we're actually doing when we're reading God's Word, and just what exactly it is that we're accomplishing. Thus, the question that I started with, what are we doing when we're reading? What are we doing when we're learning? That's kind of why it's important. So reading, then, this activity that we call reading, should establish that interface, that joining together of us and the text of God's Word. An interface, which is the word I've been using to describe this, an interface allows the substance of God's Word to get out of the text and into us. And once it's in there, then it can do its effectual work. But it has to get in there properly in order to effectually work properly. And we have to do work to get that content inside of us in the first place. And that work is establishing this so-called interface, which is to say, reading, both of those forms of reading that we just talked about. That's what reading does. So in short, reading is necessary for, first of all, the proper effectual working of God's Word, of the sonship curriculum, and by extension, it's necessary for the successful edification resulting from the orderly process, the orderly progress of that effectual working. So by effectual working, I mean that God's words, once you actually get them into your inner man, they do something. They do work in your inner man. They don't just sit there, but they add something new that wasn't there before. They remove something. They change or modify or rearrange things in your mind, in your inner man. That's the working, and effectual describes the quality of that working. And that effectual working, as we know from sonship, is supposed to happen in the order that God designed it to happen. And when it does, we have what we call edification. We have that building up of effectual work, piece by piece and layer by layer, which gradually, over time, and to outward appearances, presents itself as growth. Growth in skill, in capacity, in understanding, ultimately growth in godliness, or God-likeness, being like God in certain respects, which is, of course, the objective that we're after altogether. But none of that stuff happens automatically. We all have to work to achieve it. There's a curriculum, as we know, and there's things to be gained from that curriculum. And reading, the act of reading, is literally pivotal in us achieving this, because reading establishes that interface for taking the curriculum's content and getting it into you and getting it into me. And that's why this is so important for us to think about, even though at the start, when you talk about reading, it seems like a ridiculous thing to be talking about, but it really is so important. So that's kind of the bare bones issue. That's the nutshell-sized version of it. That's why it's important to think about what we're doing when we're reading and not just that we are reading God's Word. Because that's the point. The act of reading is the point where God's word and our inner men meet up and interact with one another. And it's important because that meeting up of us and God's word can go well or it can go poorly, and the quality or the thoroughness of our edification really does hinge on how well that meeting up goes. So what I want to do in this session then is really just raise that issue to make us aware of it and why it's important. Aware so that this kind of thinking will be in our minds when we're back working through the curriculum. And more specifically, I want us to think about how it is that we interact with this curriculum. Now that we know how important it is, how we interface with it, how we read its content, first so that we get better at learning what the curriculum actually teaches us, and second, so we start paying attention to how it actually works, how it actually works with us, and how it works with the people around us. So to work toward that, I want to do three main things in this session. The first thing I want to do is I want to give us a place to start when it comes to thinking about this issue of reading and learning from the Sonship curriculum. I want to give us a bit of something to chew on when it comes to pondering what exactly interfacing with the curriculum is really like. And after that, second thing I want to do, I want to look at a quick example of a poor interface with the Sonship curriculum. And an interface, a way of learning the content that doesn't actually allow edifying to take place. And third, the final thing I want to do in this session is look at this reading issue, this learning issue, in the context of Sonship more broadly. I don't want to leave us fixated on one aspect alone. I want us to see some of the basics of how this reading issue fits in with other aspects of the curriculum. So the first thing is to start thinking of reading as this interface between us and God. And this is a very, very difficult activity to talk about. There's no vocabulary that I'm aware of. No, it's hard to find the words to really express how this works. Even when we do think about reading, what the activity actually is, we tend to kind of take it for granted, really. We're modern people, we're living in modern times, we have modern minds, and because of that, we have a rather limited concept of what the act of reading actually is. For example, that reading is nothing more than apprehending words and meaning from the page. And that's quite understandable, because if we're reading a newspaper, a fictional story, or almost any, you know, man-made text that's out there, then maybe that is all that reading really is, words and meaning and nothing more. But the issue is, when we're interfacing with the Sonship curriculum, we should be getting a whole lot more out of it than just that. Reading as a son involves more than words, syntax, and meaning. It should actually lead to the restructuring of your mind, of your inner man. And I'm not going to go into a full-blown analysis of how this actually works. I'm not sure that I could or that I even should. But I just want to raise the issue so you can start paying more attention to it and hopefully appreciate why this is so important and why our Father's methodology, like Mark has been talking about, is so important. But what I will offer you, like I said a moment ago, is something to chew on, a place to start. And what I've got for you is hopefully a somewhat helpful image of what this act of reading actually is, a mental picture for you to kind of think about. And this has helped me think about this and appreciate its importance, and hopefully it will help you. This isn't my image, I didn't come up with it, and it isn't God's image, at least not precisely, though he does use plenty of other images in his teaching. This image actually comes from the English language itself, and we can listen to language to let it clue us into what's really going on with our minds when we're reading a text. So picture this. Consider this image. Thinking. Thought is a thread. Thought is a thread. And while stories and conversations spin yarns, as we say, the most robust writers and the most robust thinkers are weavers. They weave those threads of thought together in such a way that the result is a tightly knit cloth of thoughts and thinking, kind of like what Mark hinted at with his language earlier. A fabric is the result a fabric that's woven out of the very same material that makes up the writer's own mind. That's kind of the image I'd like us to think about, and really for the rest of the session. This idea, this image that I just gave you of weaving, is actually an ancient metaphor for writing. And it was influential enough that scribes, who are those people who record thinking for future reading, and particularly the Latin scribes who had certain influence over the English language, they called the written page, the work that they did, they called the written page a textus, which in Latin means cloth. They considered the written page a cloth or a fabric, something that is woven together. And in this case, it's woven out of that mental thread, out of thought itself. And this, in turn, is the heritage of several of the English words that we use every day. Text, obviously, textile, which still refers to cloth. Texture, context, context. All of those issue from the Latin word textus. I do mean the generic Latin textus, not this specialized English version. If you don't know that distinction, don't worry about it. So text, then, the text of the word that we have, the written page, doesn't just refer to written work, but it refers to that work's character. And its character is the weaving together of many threads of thought into this unique whole that we hold as a text. And listening to our language in this way, and why I'm bringing all of this up, it's instructive and it's profitable because it can help us transcend what I mentioned earlier. It can help us transcend what we might simply take for granted when we think about what reading is. The written page is not merely, or at least the written page of God's word, is not merely words, syntax, and meaning. It's the carefully woven product of God's own mind. And again, this image is not doctrine, it's not a piece of our curriculum. But even so, it may help us understand what is supposed to happen to us when we're actually reading God's word. When we read doctrine, when we think about what the curriculum is. And what this image helps us express very clearly, and this is why I bring it up, what this helps us express is that reading, this act of reading, in a very real way, constitutes two minds at interface. Two minds at interface with each other through the medium of the text, which itself, we know, is woven out of thought. So the image is kind of this. When you or I are reading through the sonship curriculum that we have, your mind and God's mind should be at interface with one another. They're supposed to be at interface with one another. That's the intent. God's mind has unfurled from itself this neatly woven material of thought, this text that we have in the curriculum. Your mind is there to be renewed or rewoven, we might say, according to the pattern that God established in that text. And part of that work that we do of reading through this curriculum is the common taken for granted way that we often think of reading, apprehending these words, grammar, syntax, acquiring what the writer means. But God's sonship curriculum allows reading to be much more than just that. It's opening an interface so that his mind can almost literally reach in and work in our minds to do that effectual work that I talked about before, to change something, to add something, to remove something. That's what reading allows, or should allow, if we do it properly, to happen. This isn't just reading a newspaper or reading a novel. This is a deeply personal and heart-to-heart sort of reading that we can achieve with this curriculum if we do the work of actually doing it. We do attend to words and meaning, we do gather information, but when we're reading the sonship curriculum, we do far more than that. We establish kind of an intimate liaison between two different minds, between God's mind and our mind, a liaison where the mind of the reader, us, is quite literally renewed and reformed and rewoven by the writer as we're doing this work of going through the curriculum. And talking about reading in this way may sound a bit odd at first, which is why I tried to use this linguistic image to help things along. But in sonship, if you think about it, this actually fits quite naturally. The curriculum can't just give you inert information. It has to give you active information, living information. It has to change you in order to achieve its objective. And that objective, as we all know, is to realize God's original vision for mankind, which is to be a godly being, like we were just talking about, a God-like being. The curriculum provides the means to that end, and part of the means is that we have to read in this way to actually achieve that God-like objective, because we're not God-like when we start, but we should be God-like when we reach the end. And part of the work of changing our inner man is getting the doctrine in there in the right way, and reading, as we're talking about it, is pivotal in that process. It's pivotal because that interface that we establish between the text can go well or it can go poorly. And it doesn't go poorly because God's text is faulty. It goes poorly because the way a human being interfaces with that text is faulty. It's not as personal, it's not as intimate, it's not as curricular as it needs to be to achieve its objective. If our interface or engaging with God's word isn't that penetrating into our inner man and as organized as it needs to be, if it isn't as personal and intimate and curricular as God intended it to be, then that affects how well God's word actually effectually works in us. My point is that there's really quite a lot at stake when it comes to reading and learning and interacting with the sonship curriculum. There's a lot at stake. Nothing happens automatically, and there's a lot on us to get this working properly. We don't just read for information, but we let or allow the curriculum to change our thinking and our disposition to be more like God's thinking and disposition is. And really, once you get used to this idea, this sort of reading is really no more or less difficult than regular reading. It's just different, but it is necessary. So that personal connection, that intimate heart-to-heart form of reading that we are able to engage in with the text of God's word, that really makes it possible for us to be changed into something godly. That's what makes it possible, because otherwise the doctrine is just sitting there. But we need to get it into us, and get it into us properly, and that's where reading and learning come in, and doing those things properly. So that is kind of what I offer in terms of a starting place, and it is just a starting place. We can start to think of reading as part of that interface with the text, and think of that interface as the means to an end, and think of that end as the godly objective of sonship. And there's much more to ponder than that, but that's a start. That lets us start appreciating how important it is that we engage with God's word in a personal way rather than just an informational way. But I do want to press on with those two other tasks that I mentioned I wanted to do. I want to show you an example of a poor interface with the sonship curriculum, what a poor interface looks like. And then I want to take this understanding of reading that we just talked about, and rather than looking at it in isolation, which is what we've just been doing, see it in its proper context. And in both those things, we need to be aware of two properties of this curriculum that we have, this mental fabric. We need to be aware of the form of the curriculum, and we need to be aware of the curriculum's content. And those are two different things. Content is what the curriculum is made of. It's the substance. To use that fabric analogy, it's the individual threads. In other words, content is the doctrine, the exhortations, the instruction in various skills and abilities that the curriculum contains. Form, which is just as important, is how that content is shaped and delivered. Using our cloth analogy, form is the structure that's formed by all the threads when they are actually woven together into a cloth. Or putting it another way, form is not just the words of the curriculum, but the structure that is formed by the words when those words are in their order, like they are in the curriculum. this form is important because we may have the right threads, the right content, but if they don't weave together properly, then the resulting fabric won't be at all like what God unfurled in his text. That's why form is important. Content is important because it's the substance of the curriculum that actually does the effectual work in us, actually makes those changes. And reading, as you can probably guess by now, is important because it's the actual work of getting that content out of God's Word and into us, where it can actually do that work in our inner man in the right order, so it can all weave together properly and produce that godly result. That is what is at stake when we read and learn from God's Word, that we interface with the curriculum more and more deeply, that we allow it to change us more and more deeply, rather than just pulling in information and ideas. Because that's not automatic. We have to do the work, as you all know, of going through this curriculum. And to grasp that a bit more, I think it's worth looking at an example of a poor interface with the Sonship curriculum, an interface that doesn't allow this to happen the way it's supposed to. So to do that, if you want, you can find your way to 2 Timothy, find the fourth chapter, and find the first few verses. So 2 Timothy chapter 4, and the first few verses. Before diving into this, I do want to be clear what we're doing here, and more importantly, what we're not doing here in 2 Timothy. And we're not here for effectually working, edifying doctrine. I don't think we're ready for that. We're not fulfilling the edificational potential of this passage, but because of how the pastoral epistles are structured, we can see interesting examples of sonship learning in action. So, mainly for my own conscience, let me explain that a bit. Paul sets out the pastoral epistles mandate of sorts in the opening verses of 1 Timothy, which we were actually at earlier. And you don't need to turn there, but I do just want to explain something quickly. If you look at those opening verses of 1 Timothy later, you'll see Paul mention three things, or three classes of things. He mentions Timothy himself, who is exemplary of the bishop, of the bishop's office. He mentions, like we saw earlier, this thing called godly edifying, which is in faith, which is exemplary of the purpose and the practice of sonship. And he also mentions these other things called fables and genealogies, which are exemplary of things that prevent or interfere with sonship edification. And in general, and this is just in general, each pastoral epistle is built around those three issues. First, they edify the bishop. They effectually work in him, in his own inner man. Second, they help him produce this godly edifying, which is in faith, in other sons, so the bishop can get them through the curriculum properly. And third, once godly edifying is working properly, these epistles help the bishop to preserve that edifying process from anything that might try to thwart it. So those three imperatives are kind of woven together through all of the pastoral epistles. And that's why we can also use them, instead of for their edificational value to a bishop, we can also use these epistles for examples of sonship learning going well and sonship learning going poorly, because that's what they deal with. And that's what we're doing here. We're looking for an example. We're not looking for this edifying doctrine, because that's for bishops, not for us. So with my conscience clear, and that said, in the beginning of 2 Timothy 4, we can find such an example of this thing, and it's an example of godly edifying not working properly. And it's not working properly primarily because the sons here are ignoring the form, that form, not the content. They've got the content, but they're ignoring the form of the sonship curriculum. Basically, they're not interfacing with the curriculum properly. And if you're familiar with what we talk about as sense and sequence, if you've been around sonship long enough, this will be familiar. But even so, it's worth looking at this with this idea of interface, of reading and learning in our minds. So for time's sake, we can just dive into verses 3 and 4. And here Paul is giving Timothy the reason for a charge that he just gave him in the previous verses. And Paul says to Timothy, For the time will come when they, particular sons, will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. And that's followed by a further charge from Paul to Timothy. And there are a lot of things going on here. These verses are kind of filled to the brim with things that effectually work in a bishop, like managing a local assembly, dealing with the adversary's policy of evil, etc., etc. Most of those things are things that you and I are not equipped to learn yet, but we can see an example of a broader issue going on here, which is that godly edifying does not work properly, doesn't work the way it's supposed to, when it's not in its proper form. Even if the content is unsullied, so to speak, without the proper form to that content, it's problematic. It doesn't actually edify. So there are two main things we should notice here in these verses. First, we have sons dealing with, as it says, unsound doctrine, with stuff that doesn't edify the way it's supposed to. Specifically, rather than godly edifying, which is in faith, they end up with what Paul calls here fables. That's the first thing. And second, there's a reason for that problem, the lust and itching ears that Paul mentions. And you should see that the one leads to or causes the other. The lust causes these fables. So let's look at the result first, then the cause, the fables, then the lust that leads to them. Fables come up a fair bit, and we actually talked about them earlier, which is a clue that they're quite serious things. In fact, Paul cites them in those opening verses of 1 Timothy that we were just dealing with, that I just mentioned. And there's a lot to say about fables, but I'm only going to say what's kind of relevant to us right here, which is that fables are in that third class of things that I mentioned before, along with genealogies and other nasty names that Paul uses about things, things that can thwart or interfere with godly edifying. Fables are a part of that group. And what's relevant to our point here is why fables are actually a problem and how it is that they can thwart godly edifying. And you probably already have a general idea of what a fable actually is. You could simply call them moralistic stories. That's about as good a description as any, at least for modern usage. You've heard of Aesop's fables or any of the other famous fable traditions that are out there. And a fable, basically in its essence, its fundamental character, is that a fable takes a tiny little kernel of wisdom and wraps it up into a tiny little bundle, into a little package of learning that's very easy to teach and very easy to remember. That's kind of what a fable is. If you think about Aesop's fables or something like that, that's what they actually are. What's going on here is that Paul and Timothy are not actually concerned with those external worldly fable traditions like Aesop's fables coming into the assembly. The cause of these fables tells you that, and older English usage of the word fable tells you that. Paul and Timothy here are actually concerned with something that's way more dangerous than just that. They're concerned with the sonship curriculum being transformed into fables. They're concerned with the individual doctrines of sonship being taught in the same form as those little bundles of learning that we call fables. They're concerned with sons being taught in such a way that the sonship curriculum becomes of no more edifying value than any other set of fables that we could find. And that happens, or it can happen, through that lust and heaping of teachers that I'll go back to in a moment. So the question is, why is this actually a concern? Why is a fable a bad thing if the fable is actually a sonship doctrine that comes straight out of the curriculum? The fundamental problem with a fable, from this perspective at least, is that a fable, by its very nature, is self-contained. Fables are self-contained bundles of wisdom and instruction, those little kernels of wisdom. And because they're self-contained, by definition, they're not woven together into a whole unit. To use that thread and fabric image that we were using before, fables are equivalent to a single thread, a single self-contained thread, which stands on its own and is not woven together with other threads to form a whole cloth. In other words, these fables that Paul is talking about here in this passage, they're problematic because they only carry the content of the curriculum. They don't carry the curriculum's form, its shape. They have only a part of what they need to edify a son properly. And the teachers in this passage, the teachers that these lustful sons heap to themselves, they are, one way or another, pulling threads out of this textual fabric. They're pulling out individual doctrines and individual bits of instruction and then teaching those as self-contained topics rather than as a unified curriculum. And of course, when they're doing that, they're ignoring the neat, orderly pattern of doctrines and instruction that God wove together precisely in the form that he did. And the result is that that simply cannot edify properly. If, for example, you're taught a self-contained doctrine in a fable style, then that thread, that bit of God's thinking, has nothing already established in your inner man to weave itself into. If you're taught about, say, godly equity, just out of the blue, that instruction cannot edify properly. It cannot effectually work because the threads of godly wisdom, justice, and judgment haven't been woven into your inner man yet. There's nothing for that equity thread to attach itself to. There's nothing for it to build from. So the right threads, woven in the wrong pattern, to use this analogy, don't do what they're supposed to because they can't. And that is how seemingly sound doctrine, the actual content of the curriculum that God designed, can in fact produce unsound results and lead sons, as Paul says in this verse, to turn their ears from the truth. The truth is the proper form. The truth isn't just the content. The truth is the proper method of edification. And the sons here are turning away from it, as Paul says and warns Timothy about. To put the issue more forcibly, if that happens, then the sonship curriculum for godly edifying has essentially been reduced to the status of fable. The curriculum's content, without its form, is little more than those self-contained kernels of doctrine, kernels that don't weave together to change the inner man. So that's an example of a quote-unquote faulty interface with the sonship curriculum. The curriculum isn't faulty, but the interface with it is. And it's not, the point is not that we're forbidden from looking up bits and pieces of the curriculum. The point is, the content must do its work in the right order. The work has to be in order, in the right form. And that work comes from that very personal and intimate reading interface that we just so painfully talked about in the opening bits of this session. That meeting up of two different minds, the meeting up and joining of God's mind and our mind. The curriculum facilitates that meeting up. Fables do not facilitate that meeting up. So this interface issue, which is attached, of course, to this reading issue, is key, and it's very easy to break if we're not careful. So I also want to point out just how easily this fableization of sonship doctrine can actually happen, and this passage is a very good one because it gives us some causal insight into how this can actually occur. So if you want to kind of amuse yourself on your way home or whatever, think about how lust and itching ears, those two terms Paul uses, think about how lust and itching ears could lead otherwise dedicated and enthusiastic sons to heap to themselves teachers and thereby transform the sonship curriculum into fable. And the fundamental problem there is basically not having the patience to learn things in order. Essentially, that's what lust boils down to. But to really appreciate that and appreciate how easily it can happen, you have to empathetically understand another son's position. Try and put yourselves in the shoes of another son who is literally so in love with the sonship curriculum, so delighted by the doctrines and the instruction that it offers, that they don't just desire the doctrine, they actually lust after it. That's the key. Put yourself in those shoes and see if you can empathetically appreciate how a son either on his or her own, or perhaps with a bit of a nudge from the adversary's policy of evil, how a son could be tempted to try and lustfully gobble up sonship doctrine as fast as they can without really caring for the proper order, the proper form, or the proper procedure of the curriculum, because that's really what Paul is referring to here. This passage isn't talking about physical lust or lust for material things, it's talking about doctrinal lust. But doctrinal lust still behaves much the same way, because it's still lust, and lust in broad strokes, and certainly in this instance, is basically desire run amok. Desire is quite normal and even necessary. You have to desire sonship and its teachings. You have to want it dearly. That's what leads all of us to cry, Abba Father, and pursue sonship in the first place. Taking delight in sonship is absolutely necessary. But, just as with any other object of affection that we might have, lusting after sonship doctrine can lead sons to discard their propriety, to put it that way. It can lead, either on its own or through that kind of nefarious influence, to wanting to satisfy that doctrinal lust with heaps and heaps of doctrine. Doctrine that doesn't actually edify, because it's gobbled up in heaps, rather than in the form of the curriculum. It's gobbled up in those self-contained bundles, a topic on this subject, a topic on that skill, a lesson on charity here, a lesson on equity there, a dash of something else thrown in for good measure. Those, Paul says, are fables, learning doctrine in heaps, rather than as a curriculum, rather than that mental interface that we appreciate is so valuable to sonship edification. So in sonship, I guess you could say, as in other areas of life, a little bit of self-control is a good thing to have. Not just to learn, but to learn patiently and in order. And this is a very good example of that, and how this reading interface with God's mind can go awry. So those are the first two things that I wanted to deal with. We talked about reading, and hopefully appreciate that a bit more. We've seen an example of how that can not work. Before we go on to the third thing, and this again is more for my own conscience than anything else, I want to point out two important side issues before we deal with that third thing. I kind of feel obligated to, even though you probably have a sense of this already. First, the first side issue. Fables, as we just dealt with them, can be fixed. They're not total doom to a son. If somebody's learned doctrine as a set of topics, as a set of fables, that is entirely recoverable. It can be fixed. After all the threads, such as they are still there. They can be rewoven properly. All it takes is getting back to that curricular form of learning. But still, it's best, of course, to avoid those sorts of problems in the first place. That's the first side issue. The second is this. Godly edifying and its associated issues is not the only good and proper use of the text of God's word. We use his word not only to edify ourselves, but to guide weaker brothers. We use it to explain sonship edification to believers who are unaware of that. We use it to explain right division to believers who are unaware of that. We use it to act as an ambassador to unbelievers. In short, godly sonship edifying is not the only end to which God's word is a means. We can, we do, and we are supposed to use it in more ways than just that. And for what it's worth, this applies to what I'm doing in this session as well. And this means, therefore, that it might be entirely acceptable for us to unfurl a single thread of that text if our objective in doing so does not pertain to sonship edifying. But instead, maybe our objective is to make, say, a factual point to somebody that we're an ambassador to. If you're delivering the gospel, or explaining the difference between law and grace, or talking about water baptism, or whatever, or maybe you're simply trying to track down that something Paul is talking about in the curriculum, then in those cases you may well need to move quickly and hop around the Bible from place to place, not because you're burning with lust and chasing after fables, but because you're pursuing a different objective altogether. You're being an ambassador, a stronger brother, or a studious son, and each of those is a perfectly necessary objective on its own, with its own means to that objective. The catch is, we've got to match the appropriate means with the appropriate objective. If we don't, like we just saw with these fables, things get mixed up and problems happen. So again, you're probably familiar with those issues, at least I just wanted to mention them so we don't get overly fixated on just one property of God's Word at the expense of others. So before moving on to the final thing I want to deal with, let's just regroup here for one moment. We started with the issue of reading and learning and shifted into the importance of interfacing with God's Word in this intimate way. We've just looked at one example of how that interface can go awry, fables and lust, basically. But there's a larger point to carry forward from that. And the point is, we can also benefit from paying attention to how that interface is actually working with us. Not just that it's happening, but how it's actually working as it's happening. And this is the final thing I want to deal with. And like I said earlier, I'm going to treat this by looking at this issue of reading in its context rather than independently. Earlier in that first little segment we dealt with, we were kind of zoomed in on the act, the activity of reading itself. Now I want to actually zoom back out and see reading in a broader context of sonship edification more broadly. So for that, you can flip back a few pages to 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 13. So 1 Timothy 4, 13. And you're probably familiar with this verse already. Paul is saying to Timothy, "Till I come, give attendance to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine." And there is reading. The issue of reading fit in with a whole bunch of other things. And we don't need to deal with this whole passage here. Basically, what's going on in this chapter is that those three pastoral imperatives that I mentioned before weave together in such a way that at this point, Paul has to go back to basics with Timothy and deal with that. All I'll deal with here are the two chunks of this verse that are really most relevant to the point we're trying to make here. First, there are three activities or three tasks. There's reading, there's exhortation, and there's doctrine. There are three things to do, so to speak. And the second thing, there's a charge to give attendance to each of those three things. So let's look at that three-item list first, then we'll go back and deal with the attendance issue. So first, this list of three items. And this list, for lack of a better term, is an edificational process. In other words, it's how the proper content gets into us in the proper order so that it can properly work in us, in our inner man, and produce that godly change that sonship is supposed to bring about. And I believe Mark has taught on this before at some point, so if you want more background on this process and what these three things are, then you can find that material. But the gist of it is all we need here, and it's this. There's a list of things to accomplish in this edificational process, and there's more than just doctrine on that list. Doctrine isn't the only pivotal thing involved in proper edification. There's also exhortation, and there's also our old friend, reading. And reading is actually the first thing on the list. Doctrine is actually the last one. And now that we've hopefully, after that painful opening segment, got a better appreciation for what the actual act, the activity of reading is, or rather, what the activity of reading should be, we can start to see reading in its proper context, which is what we have here. And that context is, as that act of interface, reading, both private and guided in class by a pastor, reading helps to ground this edificational process. So let's quickly sketch out an outline of this process, and we'll start at the end and we'll work our way backwards. The last item on this list here is doctrine. And doctrine, which Mark has summarized elsewhere, and he put a slide up as well, doctrine is a body of information. It is that, but it's a body of information that is designed to get into your mind, and in some cases other bits of your inner man as well. It's designed to get in there and affect it. It's supposed to cause or do something in you once it gets in there. It's supposed to work there to effectually do its work there. Remember those three things? To add something, to change something, to remove something. That's the work of doctrine. But doctrine cannot do that work automatically, and doctrine cannot do that work on its own. That's why there's a process. And there are two other things that must happen before receiving doctrine, so the doctrine can actually have its full effect. So move back one item on the list, and you get exhortation, which is one of those prerequisites. And exhortations, again, to summarize what Marcus taught elsewhere, exhortations prime the inner man to receive doctrine. They do that by rousing the inner man and preparing it for activity. Arousal is a preparatory state of being. It prepares us, it primes us for imminent action. And exhortations do that for our inner man. They rouse your inner man to activity. They wake it up and rouse it and prepare it to make it ready to engage with the coming doctrine. Exhortations make you ready to receive doctrine by producing in your inner man a state where the doctrine can easily enter in and do its work. So that's doctrine, that's exhortation. Now back up one more item on the list, the first item on the list, which is our old friend, reading. Reading is prior to both exhortation and doctrine. And hopefully now, after that agonizing talk about reading at the beginning, we've got a deeper appreciation for just what reading, the sonship curriculum, actually is. For one thing, reading opens that interface between you and God. And what does that interface do? What's it for? It's so the substance of the sonship curriculum, the doctrine, the exhortations, the instruction, can reach its destination in the inner man, so that the proper content can flow in there in the proper order, so that it can actually achieve its results, so it can flow in there and do what it's supposed to do. The form regulates and controls that flow of content, so it can renew and reweave, as we said before, what it finds there, so that when the doctrine gets in there, it knows where it has to go, and it can do the work in your inner man that it's supposed to. It doesn't do that automatically. You have to follow the proper procedure. Otherwise, it doesn't work. In other words, the orderly procedure here lets the content not only work, but effectually work. And gradually, as this happens with more and more doctrine, it edifies. It builds up. It leads to growth. Growth in skill, in capacity, in understanding. Growth in godliness, God-likeness, because that's its objective, and that's the source of the text that we're reading from. So that's kind of the process, and that's why reading, both privately or guided by a pastor's teaching, is such a pivotal part of that process. It doesn't work without it. The process doesn't work without it. Take out any of those bits and it doesn't work, or at least it doesn't work the way it's supposed to. So there is one final thing, if that's not enough, that I want to point out here. And the issue is, there's very good reason to pay attention to this edification process as we go through it. Not just that we go through the process, but that we pay reflexive attention to it as we're doing so, because that can help us learn and it can help us interact with one another. First, notice what this verse does not say. It does not say, go read, go exhort, go indoctrinate. It doesn't say that. It does not say, go and do these three things. It does not say, go perform this process. Instead, it says, give attendance to those things. Give attendance to those three bits of the process. It treats those three things less as action, less as activity, and more as object, something to think about and consider rather than do. They are, of course, activities. Each one of those is something that you do, but they're treated here in this verse as object, as something to think about. And the parts of speech that are used in this verse to explain the bits of this process are actually consistent with this. We don't have read, exhort, indoctrinate. We do have read, ing, etc. The ing is actually rather important. Instead of three verbs, three activities, we have two nouns and we have reading, which is a gerund form of the word, and a gerund, don't worry about it, is just a verb used as a noun, in other words, an action, an activity, treated as an object, something that you think about, not just something that you do. Those structural elements, attendance, giving attendance to things, all of that leads us to consider those things as objects, not just activity. In other words, it's not just the activity of doing it that's important. The point here is to observe and reflect upon the activity. Why? Because it can help you actually achieve the sonship objective, because you know how it works. This verse is not just telling a bishop to do or perform this process. It is telling him to do that. It's also telling him to pay attention to it, to how it works, so we can learn how it works. And again, I'm not after the bishop-only bits of edifying here. The point here is simply that understanding this bears upon how we, you and I as sons, are taught by a bishop. And that, in turn, should bear upon how we as sons take up and think about what we're taught by a bishop, because we better appreciate what he's trying to do when he teaches. And this is a very reflexive passage. It encourages reflexivity, a reflexive awareness of action. And reflexive simply means that the activity that somebody does reflects back on them in some way. Basically, that they're aware of what they're doing. Self-awareness. They're paying attention to what they're doing as they're doing it. And this is an important skill for a bishop to have, of course, but it's profitable even for sons in the earlier stages of their learning, and it becomes more and more useful as we all press on through the curriculum. So a bishop is wise to sow the seeds of this skill as early as he can. And the point is really a simple one. Being reflexive is like watching yourself do something in a mirror. You can pay close attention to what you're doing, and you can watch what you are doing as you are doing it. In other words, you can, as the verse says, give attendance to what you're doing as you're doing it, this edificational process. So there's good reason to pay reflexive attention to this process as it happens, to give attendance to those bits and pieces, to watch yourself, to pay attention to what you're doing as you're learning sonship, as you're reading the doctrine, as you're listening to a pastor teach, not just to take it in, but to pay attention to the process, to the form, so that you learn how the curriculum actually works as you go through it. And I think that's worth saying again, just to make the point clear. This passage is indeed specifically addressed to bishops. It has meaning, and it has effectual working intended for them alone, and rest assured, I'm not trying to make that stuff work in you. I know you're not all bishops, I'm not either, I'm just trying to help. But part of being a bishop, part of being that surrogate father for the sons in your charge, is gradually making those sons more and more capable users of this edificational process, more and more capable users of the sonship curriculum. And part of using and benefiting from this sonship curriculum and the process of learning sonship as a whole, part of that is appreciating in greater and greater detail how it all actually works, how it actually does its work. And a good way to learn that, perhaps even the best way to learn that, is to actually watch it happen, to reflexively pay attention to it as it works in you and as it works in the people who are around you. And that's something that we don't need to be a bishop to start appreciating. And I do mean start appreciating, because like everything else in sonship, it starts small and this ability grows. For an example of how that starts small and how it grows, has your pastor ever encouraged you to pay attention to how information is presented to you, to pay attention to the way in which information is structured? I know Mark has said that. That's probably a direct quote. There is a purpose to those things, because when we think about how information is presented to us, when we think about what exactly is happening to us when we learn, to go back to the question I started with, when we pay attention to what we're actually doing when we're reading, what are we doing? We're being reflexive. We're turning ourselves and our own activities into the object of our own attention. We're watching what we're doing as we're doing it. And that kind of reflexive attention can help us. It can help us learn the skills and instruction that the curriculum offers, and it can help us appreciate not only what we're learning, but how we're learning it, because we're paying attention to those things as they're happening. And this is why giving attendance not only to instruction, but to the process of instruction is worth our while. And I'll grant you that this is a bigger issue for bishops and for men of understanding than it is for, sounds like, you and me who are near the beginning. That's very true. But there are still some benefits to this awareness very early on. And here are two of them. One of them is more present, the other one is more forward-looking. The first benefit that we can get from giving attendance to how we're learning, the first benefit is, if we're paying attention to how we're being taught, how we're learning, if we're watching ourselves in a mirror, so to speak, then we can notice possible errors and mistakes that we make as they happen, as we make them. We can nip them in the bud, so to speak, rather than carry on for who knows how long before the problem is pointed out by, say, a checkpoint in the curriculum. It's kind of like doing physical exercises with the benefit of a mirror. If your form is off, if you're doing something wrong, you can notice that immediately because you're watching what you're doing. You're giving attendance to it. And especially if you have people to help, like an assembly, you can correct those problems immediately rather than waiting for them to fester and grow and having to deal with them later on. Likewise, a reflexive awareness of how we are actually learning sonship can prevent us from slipping into bad habits. Bad habits like, say, trying to extract one of those self-contained threads of doctrine, like a fable, or reading in that way. We can notice ourselves when we slip back into those bad habits, whatever bad habits we have, and we all have them. That's a benefit that each of us can get more or less right now, and it will only get stronger as we press on through the curriculum. The second benefit we can get, and like I said, this is much more forward-looking, if we learn more and more of how the curriculum works, by actually paying attention to how it works in us, then we're more and more able to see it work, and even help it work, in other people. In other people, other sons, weaker brothers, because we'll better recognize when something is effectually working in a person and when it is not. We can better perceive and understand what is going on in somebody else's inner man because we've paid attention to how it goes on in our own inner man as we went through the same thing. Now, in saying that, it's important that we not overestimate our present abilities. And aside from the skills we get in godly equity near the end of Romans, where we learn a lot about how to watch out for and protect each other as an assembly, aside from that, this skill really comes into its own in the third level of sonship education. That's when, as Mark talked about earlier, somebody looks back over the curriculum from the beginning, not from the perspective of a son, but with the eyes of a father, or at least a future father, who can now see a lot of how the curriculum actually works, and who can help it work in others. But even that new fathering skill that we acquire at that level is based firmly in old skills that we can use right now. And one of those skills is paying reflexive attention to the edification process as we each go through it. Not just going through the process blind, but giving attendance to it. Granted, not the fullness of attendance that a bishop like Timothy in this passage would be able to do, but even Timothy had to start somewhere. He didn't start out as a bishop, he started out as a regular son like the rest of us, and that's where all of us start. And these skills build and grow, and we grow in them as we all go through the process together. So that, like I said, is the final issue I want to mention. So mercifully, and I do mean mercifully, that's about all I have to say about it. So let's just regroup here one last time, and then we can eat. The point of this, as I said from the start, is simply to draw our attention to something that's important and something that will become increasingly important as we all journey on through the sonship curriculum, both independently and together. That's really all the point of this is, to draw our attention not only to what we learn as sons, but to how we learn as sons, to appreciate reading and teaching and learning as that act of interface with God, as that intimate liaison between his mind and our mind, and this is not the last word on the subject. In fact, I think it's barely the first word, but we all have to start somewhere, and the objective here is to simply take advantage, as I said at the start, of this pause that this gathering offers, to take stock and reflect upon not only what we're doing as sons, but to reflect upon how we're doing it. And that meeting up of God's mind and our mind and us changing as a result of it is absolutely pivotal to sonship learning, and we'll learn and get better at it as we all move forward together. And hopefully that, if nothing else, should be reason, sufficient reason, to start thinking about what we're doing when we're reading, to think about how we're learning and how we're interacting together, and really appreciating what exactly is going on, even when we're talking over food at Mike's house later. There's value in that. So we get better at those things, and hopefully, as we think about this and continue on, we can appreciate and love the curriculum even more than we already do. And that, again, mercifully, is all that I have to say about it right now. Thank you for being patient, by the way.